Hi, Steve Cooper, Rank Success, and welcome to another short video. And today's video is about the topic of neurodiversity in policing. And for those of you that read my blogs, you will know that I've written a couple of blogs. It was a couple of years ago now, on thinking differently in police leadership. So thinking differently about neurodiversity in police leadership. And it's been a couple of years since I wrote a two-part series, if you like. I've written part three recently, so yesterday, and put it out, which is why I'm doing this video now. And I just wanted to share, there's been quite a lot of learning and insight and discovery for me personally through looking at this topic in relation to policing. And over the last couple of years, there has been some traction, I suppose, gained within policing for neurodiverse officers. And neurodiversity is about the way the brain thinks differently. So we recognize that term as, you know, individuals, people with conditions such as ADHD, dyslexia, dyscalculia, dyspraxia, on the autistic spectrum. And those officers, those individuals, those people are within policing, within police officers and police staff. And it hasn't always been easy for them. And when you have a dive into the topic, as I've done, you can see why. But there has been some traction gained within policing. So round about the time that I wrote my blog, there or abouts, the College of Policing has appointed an Assistant Chief Officer Lead, Alexis Poole, to head up neurodiversity within policing nationally. So that's a kind of indication, organisationally, of a commitment to supporting people who have neurodiverse issues or conditions. And I think ideally people want us to move away from that, even talking about it like that, to the point where they're just people. So you've got neurotypical people, which is probably the likes of you or I, depending on what you, how your brain is made up. So most people in terms of social norms are neurotypical. And then you've got neurodiverse, which is thinking differently, hence the title of my blogs. And as I say, some traction's been gained with the appointment of a lead officer. The College of Policing also came up with a glossary of terms. So there's lots of different words and descriptions around this. So a glossary of terms helps in terms of people trying to understand it, trying to get to grips with it, and trying to find out what support's available if you're a cop or a member of police staff. Or you're anybody else just listening to this, or want to go and have a look at my blogs that I've written, I've probably put quite a lot of links in there to help people. And as I say, there's been quite a bit of learning for me in this, and that's an everyday occurrence. Every day is a school day with me. But the third blog that I've done, I allude to a lady called Judy Singer. And Judy Singer first coined the term neurodiversity in her thesis. And alluded to, and she herself is on the autistic spectrum, and the link is in my blog if you want to find out more about that. But very inspiring individual, and someone who kind of was a pioneer in terms of bringing neurodiversity and that term and how we think about it to the mainstream, if you like. And before that, people's attitudes are, you know, well, you were different, and accordingly, you were treated differently. The same as in organisations, but organisations, as I say, like policing, are now waking up, smelling the coffee. So GCHQ, policing, and MI5, the security services, are looking now at the benefits of the skill set that neurodiverse people can bring, because without going into that, there are a particular set of skills that some of them have. So some of them are better at numbers, better at recognizing patterns, better at organizing, and not so good at other things. So it's about how you're inclusive and how you approach and recruit and support people within the organization who have needs around neurodiversity to be able to do their job. Nothing more than that. It's nothing, no favoritism, no going out of your way, but to help people do their job. That's it, really. And then also trying to get people with that particular set of skills, just like you would anywhere else, into a particular role or job where it suits them well. But I think where it comes unstuck is where there's some traction being gained within policing and it's looking to be more inclusive. The policies are shaping up that way. There's a lot more work to go, as there is in other organisations across society. But, you know, steps in the right direction are being taken. How does that pan out for people wanting to go for promotion within the police service? Well, that's a good question, because for some people it's very much harder to go for promotion. It's a real undertaking and there's lots of issues. So what I try to say is, you know, people who are neurotypical and people who are neurodiverse all find problems with promotion. So I'm a promotion coach and mentor, and I've got lots and lots and lots of people through their promotion boards, or they've got through their boards themselves. I've just been part of the conversation. They had to go and do it themselves. But, you know, things like interviews are not always the right part of a selection process for people who find difficulty or excess difficulty. And nobody likes interviews, let's face it. It's a contrived situation. And but everybody, I'll be careful what I say, but lots of people are looking for the shortcut, i.e. I've been acting, I've been temporary, I'm well liked, I'm well respected, I'm doing the job, just promote me. And there's a case for that. There is a case for that, because, you know, if you're doing your job well and there's no competition and you're acting and temporary and you're in the spot, right place, right time, and the organisation needs you to be promoted into a position, a leadership position as a sergeant, inspector, chief inspector, then good on you. You benefit from the luck. But most of the time you make your luck by preparing as best you can for a selection process. But the word competition is something that evades and escapes lots of people. So what happens where you've got 25 people going for each vacancy? How does a force run a fair selection process to select the right people? And I suppose for me, with this work around neurodiversity that I've kind of been doing, and the little deep dive that I've been doing personally in order to write these blogs, it's been very, very interesting. And I think, you know, there is a case for different processes or processes that are inclusive for promotion. Now, that may well mean that I talk myself out of a job as a promotion coach and mentor. I doubt it, because I adapt to whatever frameworks are in place, and there have been a number of frameworks in place that policing uses to assess and the criteria for assessing promotion candidates. And no one can get out of that mode, that element of competition, because at some stage, to be fair, which is another issue with promotion processes, and I always take the stance it's unfair, and you've got to make it fairer for yourself by putting the work in and committing to a depth and preparation, a depth of you know, preparation for an opportunity that comes up. But it's right that, you know, there should be fairness within a system, and it should be accessible to people, a broad spectrum of people within policing, i.e. everybody. And everybody should be able to have an opportunity to get promoted. So, you know, if that means that, as some forces are doing now, doing away with interviews, great. But as I've alluded to in previous videos, guess what? Cops don't like what replaces interviews either. And in some of the podcast interviews I've done, I think one of them with Simon Foy, and I think also, which is a Simon Foy QPM, who is a former police commander in the Metropolitan Police, and I asked him the question, is there a holy grail for promotion selection processes? You know, if there is one, then it should be in place. Of course there isn't, but I asked him around the issue around interviews, and he said he didn't foresee, I think he said that anyway, you'll have to listen to the podcast, but I'm sure he said that he couldn't really foresee a time where an interview wasn't part of a selection process for getting the right person for the job, because you need to see them under pressure, and it is contrived, it is pressured situation. But guess what? So is doing a community briefing where you've had whatever 50 cars damaged on your patch overnight by some idiot who's gone down the road jumping on them, smashing into them, and letting the tyres down. You know, you're going to have to be under pressure there as well, in a slightly different way. But interviews, are they something that should be in every process? Arguable, debatable, but should there be another alternative process that gets people selected? And there are people who are looking at those processes now to ensure that, you know, the police service is fair in when it both recruits and selects people for positions, particularly leadership positions within policing. So this blog that I did yesterday, I've alluded to Judy Singer, who was the first lady to coin the term neurodiversity. I cover in there what it is. So, you know, autism, dyspraxia, dyscalculia, and a couple of other things, ADHD, all of which are experientially different by people. No two individuals experience neurodiversity in the same way because we're all unique. And I also looked at some of the help and support there. So there is an inspector, dyslexic inspector, who is, his Twitter name is @JB Dyslexic, who provides support and guidance and is a contact point if you want to avail yourself of a friendly, supportive, other than me of course, a friendly, supportive individual within policing who's currently committed to working and trying to make things better for neurodiverse officers and staff. And that support's available there. You've got the College of Policing lead for neurodiversity there. And then what I also talk about is some of the learning that I've done. I talk about in the blog some of the learning that I've kind of come across, where I'm regularly contacted by officers with neurodiverse issues. So, and they'll say to me, "Oh, Steve, are your masterclasses suitable for neurodiverse officers? Or are your promotion toolkits for dyslexics? You know, can they help me if I'm dyslexic?" And the short answer I've learned over time is yes to both of those. Although people experience it neurodiversity differently, there are plenty of neurodiverse officers that have been promoted, having attended my masterclasses, downloaded my promotion toolkits, but they perceived their neurodiversity as a blocker, and it may well be to some issues in life, but it wasn't for them, it wasn't to them for promotion. And that's a big difference, because this isn't about uniformity. People experience things differently. So when you look at things like a video or a digital guide or a podcast, they represent different ways of learning. So you can watch a video, you can also listen to it. Podcast, you can listen to it. Blogs, there's lots of free blogs you can read, and that may well present some difficulties, but there's lots of adjustments that can be made for people to learn and to pick up and to have materials read for them, or easy read materials. So there's always options is what I'm saying, but the short answer is yes, my products are. And I'll just read out, I'm just whipping through to the blog, this is in the blog, I'll put a couple of case studies in that blog from my contact, from my conversations with officers, and I'll just whip through to that point there. So quick look, right, okay. I struggle to find material that I can utilize and take with me. Most material relies on an internet connection, which frequently I don't have. For me, your products are a gift. I find I can listen to them whilst cooking, walking, exercising, and I can watch and feel like I'm in a personal session with you when I'm relaxing. Having my own personal masterclass video to suit my schedule or locations is important to me. I feel I miss out on so much more, as if I had other police training material in an audio format like this, it would be a delight and essential help for me. I mean, that's just brilliant for me to hear, because, you know, the short answer is no, there are specialist coaches out there, and you can just Google them and find them who coach for specific issues around neurodiversity and specific needs. Whereas I invite you to come along to a masterclass, and I'm running one this January, the 18th, February the 18th, March the 18th, ish, and I'll run some more in the later on in the year. And of course, there's the video version of it if you want to, so you can stop, start, replay it, and use it to support your learning. In conjunction with the podcasts, which are free, and the digital download toolkits that come either with the video or on their own as a digital toolkit. So again, lots of options for you there, but that was really helpful for me. And I have lots of conversations with officers, as I say, because when they say to me, "Steve, are your masterclasses for dyslexic officers, or do they help officers with neurodiversity?" Yes, the short answer is yes, but I'll often say to them, and that happened only last week, "What do you mean by that? just explain for me, just would you just be kind enough to explain to me what you mean by that neurodiversity? And then often they'll go into, you know, their own condition, their own experiences. Sometimes they don't even know that they have, they just suspect they've got an issue. So we talk about work-based assessments and whether they've actually accessed those. And sometimes that's they haven't. So they're kind of going around in circles, and that's always a good first point. There's still a reluctance to talk to supervisors about it. People don't want to disclose that they have some, particularly if the supervisor's not supportive. And that, I'll come on to that now with a couple of examples. But when I speak to officers, I've listened to some really sad stories where people haven't been supported. And some issues around how people have developed coping strategies through their life, just to get by, and mechanisms just to get by through life. How exhausting it can be for them to come to work and deal with what goes on in work normally, and then go home and just collapse, crash, because it's just such an effort to hold things together. And I was ignorant of that, in terms of empathy and understanding around that. So this has been a real kind of journey of discovery for me. And then I get to hear of outstanding supervisors who go the extra mile to help. So I've put some of the kind of one-liners that people have said to me. My supervisor went the extra mile to help me, and I really appreciate that. Or this supervisor surfed ahead of me to HR as an advocate for me and came back with information to reduce the uncertainty and anxiety I was feeling about what I needed to do. Not worried about going for promotion. It's just all the added uncertainty about, well, how can we minimise that? How can we mitigate the risks of walking in there, being overly anxious and overly concerned as a result of neurodiverse issues? I have to say most neurotypical people are that way as well, in terms of anxiety and nervousness and uncertainty. And, you know, when you come on the masterclasses, that's one of the things I kind of encourage people to do is to adopt an intelligence-led approach. So adopt an intelligence-led approach to building a picture about what to expect for a promotion selection process. Anybody can do that. But this supervisor did that for this individual. One individual came back, one sergeant came back, and said, or one individual came back and said that the valued support that they've received from the organisation has included being provided with a copy of important candidate information. And that was an interesting point for me, because I see lots and lots of draft promotion evidence, and I've seen a couple of application forms lately, and they do vary across policing. So here's perhaps one of the things the College of Policing to pick up on is sometimes, you know, the forms are different. So here's one I've got here, one I prepared earlier. Important candidate information. So what this is not a secret. This is what's going to appear on a promotion application form that everybody's going to get. And under the disability section, there is an invite, if you like, or some criteria set out by the force within that document to ensure that people can avail themselves, if they need to, of reasonable adjustments. So that can be anything from extra time to being allowed to use bespoke equipment that you have to help you do your job in a day-to-day basis, and other aspects. But this form I'm looking at the moment, important candidate information, it just goes through, and this particular force is a member of the Disability Confident Scheme, which obviously suggests, you know, that they take it seriously. And it defines the disability definition here under the Equality Act 2010, defines disability as a physical or mental impairment with long-term substantial effects on ability to perform day-to-day activities. And then it goes on to what a long-term effect is, but it also says some examples of disabilities include hearing, speech and visual impairments, which you're probably familiar with, but neurodiverse conditions, which is quite a broad set of parameters. And then it goes into reasonable adjustments. Please state the disability that you wish us to be aware of. And that was a learning point for me, because one of the officers asked me that I was speaking to, said, is it true that I can get extra time in the promotion briefing exercise to read through before I go in? And I said, yeah, of course you can, you know, go to HR, there should be an arrangement for that, and you can ask for that, because they'll have to do it under the disability considerations on the form. And he went, disability? Is dyslexic? Because I'm dyslexic, is that, am I disabled? And that was a learning point for me, because the individual, as many people with neurodiversity, do not consider themselves disabled in any way. That doesn't cut for everybody, because some people do need more reasonable adjustments. But that was a bit of a learning point for me that came under my radar, really, that, you know, I didn't expect him, with me helping him, to say, really? Seriously, Steve? Are you joking? He actually swore, but I'm not going to do that on here. So that was a learning point for him. But we had a conversation. So go along. It's all supportive. It's to enable you to do your job and to recognise that you may need that adjustment just for the reading part. And he was able to get that. But this form here also goes on. Have you previously shared your disability with the force by completing the disability assessment form and the process detailed within the force disability policy? And again, some people don't want to do that. If you don't trust the force and you have particular issues, or you don't trust your supervisors, or you don't get help from HR, it's going to be all the more difficult for something that everybody wants to be smooth as a process. So there shouldn't be any stigma, there shouldn't be any concerns or anxiety. And what I'm saying is, this important candidate information could be given to anybody. It could be given to anybody as soon as they register for a promotion process, and explain the process nice and friendly, in very supportive ways, even if it's a kind of play on this introductory section, to the individuals themselves, so that they can spend a bit of time, which is sometimes what people need, including other, you know, all promotion candidates. Give them as much information as you can, and give them as much time as you can to digest what it is they need to digest. And if it's not secret like this, it's just process, then why not? So that was just an example of a good form, and if it can be good in one force, it should be good in all forces. So there's an issue. And then just going on to the other bits of the blog, which again you can double away and read anytime you like. I mean, you can stop watching this if you want to, but I'm just going through the fact that, you know, some supervisors were brilliant, as I alluded to earlier on, and other supervisors, I've put some other words in that blog that were described to me as, my supervisor's always too busy. They're never accessible. Unapproachable. So that's something that, if you can imagine, you need to ask for help or support, and you expect your supervisor to know these issues, which again, you know, you should be aware. And I think that's one of the issues, is sometimes supervisors are not aware, sometimes even of the concept of reasonable adjustments, which if you think about it is almost unbelievable. But it's legal, that kind of stuff. It's not a choice. So if somebody asks you for help, there are some legal connotations around that, in terms of, well, look, you know, they're asking you for help. If you understand the Equality Act and your part within that, and I cover all of this, we do a slightly deeper dive than people expect into these issues, because that's what good supervision is about. It includes that, and it certainly doesn't include batting staff away or deferring them or being inaccessible or approachable when they need to ask for that help. So someone here has put, I was told to speak to HR nearer the time, and they'll tell you. Okay, compare and contrast that to the supervisor that went away and came back with the information on behalf of the individual. And then the other issue really is something I alluded to just now, is candidates asking their force HR department for assistance, which we know is available from the form when it's sent through to them eventually, perhaps just before a promotion process. But they're going along and they don't know what adjustments are available for them. So when they're asked, what adjustments do you need by the HR department, we'll see what can be done. The individual says, well, I actually don't know. I don't know what adjustments I'm asking for. What options do I have? And can we then talk about whether I qualify for those? So there's a bit of a disjointed communication and connection there. And again, this is something just that I'm pointing out from conversations I've had with people. And I'll always encourage them to go back and sit down and try and make up for the communication shortcomings of other people and try and communicate better around what your needs are. But you can see that if you don't get that support, it can be harder. But some people just say, I'd like to know some of the options that I could have available before I decide if I need it. Okay, and then just whipping through some of the issues that are common to both neurodiverse and neurotypical officers or people. Not starting preparation well in advance of a promotion selection process. So for those of you that are going to get two chances to do the sergeant's exam and two chances to do the inspector's exam, you already know now that you're going to commit to that. So you've made the decision to become a leader. So when you get through your exam on that day, have a breather and then crack straight into preparing yourself for the next steps, whatever they look like, which is generally a board or selection process. So not starting well in advance is one of the big issues common to both. Not knowing how to structure or present examples or evidence well, the toolkits can, downloadable digital toolkits you can download from ranksuccess.co.uk can help you with that straight away to hit the ground running. And we cover it on the masterclasses as well. And rushing application forms, I see that all the time. So, you know, you could choose today. If you haven't got a promotion process on the horizon, no worries. No worries at all. But you should be starting to collate and corral and marshal your evidence and examples in a way that can align to the competencies you're going to be assessed against. And you've got a draft ready to go now. But what I see is lots of people doing it last minute. And of course, the product itself, the application form itself, is not as good as it could be. And there's a kind of euphemism, really. Okay, the last bit of it, one of the other conversations I've had, a bit of feedback. Right now, I feel a lot more positive about this. I'm grateful to you, and I can't praise you enough for the support and the resources you put out for people. You really make a difference. And I'm glad to get that kind of stuff because it's out there 24/7, 365 days a year, the same hours you work. And there's always something to support promotion candidates if they want to find it at the drop of a hat, middle of the night, and you're looking through the computer and you want to find it. Ranksuccess.co.uk should get you a good start with free videos on YouTube, and podcasts and blogs. So, and that doesn't cost you a penny coin. Okay, and the last bit about this blog I wanted to do was a really, really inspiring example that I found. And I've put the title here, 38 Years in the Dark. And this relates to Becky Davis, who's a serving inspector in the police service. And she did a podcast, which I listened to as part of writing my blog. And it was published by the Late Discovered Club. Yes, there is such a thing, the Late Discovered Club, which is about discovering people who've been diagnosed late on in life with neurodiverse issues. And they share their stories. And they're really impactful about how they have developed ways to just cope with life and relationships. And that video, that podcast with Becky Davis is called Out of the Dark. And it's on a podcast called the Late Discovered Club. And I just highly recommend that you go and listen to that. Particularly if you're someone who's going for promotion or you're someone who has people on your team, your sections, and you will have with neurodiverse issues, go and have a listen to that about. And all I would say is I really enjoyed listening to her insights. I'm going to be listening to some more of those podcasts. She's clearly very articulate, open, transparent with her experiences, and I learned something new just around things like eye contact, whether people know how to make eye contact, hold it, break it, and all the connotations that that can have in terms of how you communicate with people, and then how she was able to get promoted and how she was supported within in the job. So it is available and it's very good once people know. And as I say, I would recommend that you have a listen to that. The last bit, I've put the last quote in there, I just wanted to go through, which is a quote by Harvey Bloom. And it says that neurodiversity may be every bit as crucial for the human race as biodiversity is for life in general. Who can say what form of wiring will prove best at any given moment? Cybernetics and computer culture, for example, may favour a somewhat autistic cast of mind. So the future is for the neurodiverse as well as the neurotypical. And I just find this stuff pretty inspiring and motivating, hence the three blogs I've written on it now, the further podcasts I'm going to listen to it, and I can now include that as part of my considerations around my masterclasses and my materials. So if you've got any tips around that, I'll be grateful to listen to them or receive them. And until then, I will be back. Until next time, I will be back with another video. And until then, take care and stay safe.